Renee Bingham versus the Honorable Dan R. Beck, judge, an original mandamus proceeding. And the third argument will be another consolidated matter, Donald Glenn Feltz and Mary Taylor Feltz versus Harris County, from Harris County, and State of Texas and City of Dallas versus John C. Heal and Mary C. Heal, from Dallas County. In the second matter, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and in the third matter, 30 minutes. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, but we'll conclude all of the arguments before lunch. The arguments are being tape recorded for the convenience of the court, and if you desire to listen to a tape, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from the relators in Able Supply versus Moya.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert M. Martin will present argument for the relators. The relators have reserved 12 minutes to rebuttal, and Mr. Michael Young will present the rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of this honorable body, I can describe this case very quickly and the issue that brings us before this court. It is brought by 2,030 Living Lone Star steel workers and the families of 517 deceased Lone Star steel workers who claim toxic injury against the defendants by reason of exposure to the defendant's products during their work at the Lone Star steel mill. This is not a single product case. This is not an asbestos case. It's not a silica case. It is not a class action, and there's no allegation that it's a class action. The pleading, one of the amended petitions, which is 30, 40 pages, is in the appendix, and they describe the action. These are the words, paraphrased, from that petition. The plaintiffs worked at various times between 1947 and the present time. They worked in various locations in the steel plant. And the steel plant is a big place with some clean places and some dirty places. Many, many buildings, many acres. And finally, they say that they suffer from various and sundry illnesses. That is the pleading which brings the defendants into court. These 187 suppliers supplied everything in a sort of a vernacular way, everything from paperclips to locomotives. But they supplied many, many products, some of which were used in the steelmaking business and some were not. But I want to make the point that we're talking not about a bunch of plaintiffs who admittedly have asbestos-related disease or silica, which we have seen multitudes of. To my knowledge, this is the only case of its kind that's ever been brought in the state, and I really can't find one anywhere else.
Mr. Markle, well, what about the offer to dismiss as many settlements as one out by affidavit by stating merely that they did not supply any product that caused any of
the simple answer to that, Your Honor, is it doesn't work. Timken, for example, filed last week a motion for summary judgment saying they had been trying for 3 years. Timken said in their motion, we produce steel pipe. Steel pipe does not radiate, and it doesn't emit any fumes or hurt anybody. They said the only other thing that you put was roller bearings. We've been trying to get out of this case since it was brought almost 8 years ago, and we can't get out, and now we're filing something. It is an allegation without validity. What brings us here is an interrogatory, and if I may just tell us, I'll try to get through as quick as I can. What brings us here is an interrogatory. Now, this is not just the kind of interrogatory we had in Moore versus Packer. If you recall there, one little bit of impeaching evidence, that Dr. Jones worked for a hospital that said, hey, don't you doctors testify to plaintiffs, and they wanted to get that. This is a major predicate to this lawsuit. When the cases were first filed, it was 35 individual cases, and we thought they were in good faith. We thought a lot of these people were really sick and had been hurt by the defendant's products. As you will find out, we don't believe any of them really have any valid claim. We think these are basically meritless cases. But anyhow, so the defendants all got together and we created a set of master interrogatories. So plaintiff's counsel would only have to answer for each plaintiff one side of interrogatory, so 200 defendants wouldn't be sent in countless interrogatory. We accommodated plaintiff's counsel. In late 1987, early 1988, I think January of 88, the interrogatories were finally served on plaintiff. Interrogatory number 30 is a counterpart of the interrogatory we see in every lawsuit, which says, advise us of every witness who has knowledge of relevant facts. Well, in a product's case, the product is the most relevant fact, particularly if you're talking about 161 products named by the plaintiff in his second amended case. For instance, I represent a number of defendants. One provides Lyme products, two forms of Lyme, calcium oxide and calcium hydroxide. Another one provides pure silver. I do not know, as I stand here almost 8 years later, any plaintiff who is claiming that he was hurt by sulfur or Lyme or anything else. We have no information. Anyhow, the interrogatory is the crux of this lawsuit. As you said in Walker versus Packard, this goes to the heart of the matter. The interrogatory reads, please state the name and address of each and every doctor, physician, or other medical practitioner who has attributed your alleged injury made the basis of this lawsuit to exposure to defendant's product, including the date of treatment or examination of each doctor or other medical practitioner, and, most important, the name or identity of the product to which your alleged injury was attributed. As I say, we don't know today, not one single defendant knows what product each plaintiff, anyone says, hurt
you. Now, you do have the medical records of most
of them. We have medical records of some, about 500 or more. But let me say this. There's one exception to that. When the asbestos defendants all decided to settle, they made a deal with plaintiff's counsel. He would run them through the UT Health Center at Tyler, an institute called the Texas Institute of Occupational Medicine, which incidentally could check on any kind of occupational disease. They were told to check only for asbestos. They came up with about 30% of these then 3,000 plaintiffs, I think it was, 2,700, whatever the number was, and it does vary. They came up with about 30%, showed the signature of asbestos on the x-rays. They had two x-rays, a breathing test, and a questionnaire as to what they were exposed to during their work. And that is the one exception. There is evidence, even in that case, Your Honors, there is no evidence of where they were exposed to asbestos. But that's not my business. I don't represent any asbestos defendants, and I don't care if they settle without knowledge of where the injury occurred. There has been no objection to this interrogatory. What we have gotten is a statement. Every single one of 1,000 written interrogatory answers says, this has not yet been determined, will be supplemented at a later date. This statement is signed by a plaintiff and sworn to, but it is not the answer of any plaintiff. No plaintiff said to that paralegal, Ms. Jones, I have not yet determined the answer. If Ms. Jones had said, if you are, as a doctor ever told you have a disease from the defendant's product, the guy would have said yes or no. And how do we know that? Because of 1,000 written interrogatories we have received, we have taken 500 of half of those 1,000 plaintiffs on oral deposition, as you can see in appendix exhibit 7. Every single answer was, no doctor has ever told me that I suffered from a disease or injury due to the product. Sam Fowler, whom I quote at some length, the lead plaintiff, we pressed him and said, well, what makes you think you suffered an injury? His answer is, in the record, don't ask me, I'm not a doctor. Then we pressed him and said, why did you sue? He said, well, I heard about the lawsuit. I was around that steel mill as much as most of these guys, so I just went over, signed up, and joined the party. We got a party of 2,500 steel workers going in Morris County, and we don't know if we stand here, if any of them was ever told by a physician, you have a toxic injury from a defendant's product. Matter of fact, if you use the 500 oral depositions, and those guys were telling the truth under oath across Musk, as I say, the paralegal didn't really ask a question. I think the court can reach that conclusion from 1,000 identical answers that say not yet determined. Those men, we have not taken any, there are a few women in the case, but all those men were basically elderly, retired steelworkers in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and a few in their 90s. Every one of them said no, and they had, a lot of them smoked and said they had various ailments. But they had things like prostate trouble, lower colon polyps like President Reagan, arteriosclerotic heart disease. That's a disease of almost all folks in that age bracket. And we don't find anything, I'm representing honestly to the court at this point, we don't know of any sick plaintiff. Now we've only taken 500 oral abscesses, and we've only got 1,000. And the reason we're here is we were entitled to answers under the discovery procedures 30 days after they were filed. Obviously we would have given the plaintiff's lawyer a year if he needed it. Discovery is to expedite the development of a lawsuit. Here we are 8 years later.
The respondents claim that the trial court wants you to answer some preliminary discovery first, notebook of the various products, and that until that's done, under the trial court's order, they don't have to respond to this.
Your Honor, let me address that. That is a facetious argument for two reasons. If I've got asbestos disease, which the plaintiff's lawyer established himself by sending those people over to UT Health Center in Tyler, they don't need to know who put asbestos in the plant. The question here is, what are you sick from? Are you sick from?
Well, at first, is that the trial court's order? I correctly state what the trial court's position is?
I understand what the trial court's position is.
Did I correctly state it in my question to you?
The trial court has permitted this to go on to backtrack.
Did the trial court order that the defendants do this, make this preliminary disclosure first? Or these interrogatories had to be answered?
By the case management order, which is in the file, which the trial court entered as his decision, the defendants were prohibited from almost all discovery until the plaintiff finished with a company called Litidex assembling some, they claim, 14 million documents. I don't know how many documents they've got. But prior to that, they had asked for the defendants to produce them. For my defendants, I produced a description of every product, an MSDS. This has been done years ago.
Defendants have and some haven't.
So that's correct. I would not say that all defendants, today, a lot of defendants object to every interrogatory file or every request for production. I have produced, and in addition, Your Honor, the case management order, there's a second, we've done it twice. They ask, there's ordered in that case management order a product notebook. After I got through doing this for these three clients, just a formal return of pieces of paper, I made up a notebook, and according to the court's order, which has the same information, the description of the product, MSDS, and pictures, colored pictures of the product in its packages, and colored pictures of the product poured out on a piece of white paper, and whatever, and the warning labels. And anyhow, there's a complete description. Those notebooks for my clients have been in place for 2 or 3 years. And the real facetious part, Your Honor, is the second amended petition was filed July of 1988, almost 7 years, and they named 161 chemical substances that they claimed damaged plants. The plaintiffs already know what the substances are. I'm sorry.
So your position is that the trial court abused his discretion in not...
I think the trial court abused his discretion. This court has said that mere delay and expense is not a reason for anything. We assert it. But 8 years, Your Honor, is a lot more than mere delay and mere expense. And it goes to the heart of this case. When we've got these defendants at this stage who don't know a single plaintiff that claimed it, and they're trying to keep all these defendants in here, as I've said, this is an exercise which is not the newest, it was not invented by this group of plaintiff's lawyers. This is an exercise in making the defendants spend money so they will settle. And many of them have settled.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr.
May it please the court, Mr. Nelson Roach will present argument for respondents.
How much time or have relators requested to reserve?
The relators are reserving 12 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court, my name is Nelson Roach, and I am one of the attorneys who represent the real parties in interest in the underlying litigation. In 1969, the late Justice Robert Calvert wrote what has come to be some very prophetic words in Pope versus Ferguson, which I would like to quote from the court, and that's at 455 Southwest 2nd, 954. There is sound reason why appellate courts should not have jurisdiction to issue writs of mandamus to control or correct incidental rulings of a trial judge when there is an adequate remedy by appeal. Trials must be orderly, and constant interruption of the trial process by appellate courts would destroy all semblance of orderly trial proceedings. Moreover, with this type of intervention, the fundamental concept of all American judicial systems of trial and appeal would become outmoded. Having entered the thicket to control or correct one such trial ruling, the appellate courts would soon be asked in direct proceedings to require by writs of mandamus that trial judges enter orders or set aside orders sustaining or overruling pleas to the jurisdiction, pleas of privilege, pleas and abatements, motions for summary judgment, motions for instructive verdict, motions for judgment non abstente verdicto, motions for new trial, and a myriad of interlocutory orders and judgments. And as to each, it might logically be argued that the petitioner, for want of the writ, was entitled as a matter of law to the action sought to be compelled.
Mr. Roach, let me ask you a question. Mr. Martin has said that what do you say is a predicate to Mr. Martin getting the answer to interrogatory number 30 as to the plaintiffs that claim his products caused them injury?
With respect to the question of causation, that is a very fact-intensive question that involves...
Let me start over again. What does Mr. Martin have to do on behalf of his clients to get his answer to question 30?
Number one, identification of when the products were supplied to the plant and the quantity that were supplied. Number two, identification of the constituent element ingredients. Number three, development of what the defendant knew with regard to the anticipated release of toxins during the anticipated use of the product. Those are the facts that need to come from the defendants.
No, I'm asking about Mr. Martin. You're saying Mr. Martin's clients have yet to provide you with information that you need in order to answer question number 30.
With respect specifically to Mr. Martin's clients, Mr. Martin's clients have provided some discovery. For example, Able Supply, Mr. Martin stated that none of his defendants supplied asbestos products. Able Supply was a supplier of asbestos products that were manufactured by other companies to Lone Star Steel. Able Supply has not provided information for the product exhibit notebook concerning the asbestos products that they have supplied.
So you're saying the asbestos cases have not settled?
Not all of them, Your Honor. Some have and some have not. There are approximately 20 to 25 defendants that are in the case that that we contend supplied asbestos products. Some of them deny that their products contained asbestos, and that's one of the factual issues in the case with respect to some of those defendants.
So there are some plaintiffs in this case that claim they are suffering from asbestosis that came from products supplied by Mr. Martin's clients.
That is correct.
And until Mr. Martin tells you what products they supplied, you're not going to tell him which one of those plaintiffs are the ones that have a claim against his companies.
The plaintiffs are not in a position to be able to respond to the interrogatory with the specificity that is demanded in the interrogatory until that information is provided.
Does Rule 13 require you to at least have a good faith investigation on behalf of your clients to determine that they have a claim against Mr. Martin's clients?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. And
have you made that determination?
Yes, Your Honor, we have.
And can you identify those plaintiffs?
Can we identify those plaintiffs?
By name, that have a claim against Mr. Martin's clients.
We're contending that all of them have claims against Mr. Martin's clients.
All of these plaintiffs have a claim, and under Rule 13, you have a good faith belief in that statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I'll be clear about that. You mean every one of them?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I will say, with respect to some of these defendants, as discovery has progressed in the case, it has come to pass that with respect to some of the defendants, their products were not supplied to Lone Star Steel during particular periods of time. And with respect to those individual defendants, there are plaintiffs who do not have claims against some of the defendants. But specifically with respect to Mr. Martin's clients, his clients, for example, the line defendant that he has supplied line to Lone Star Steel beginning in 1947 and did so continuously up until at least 1987. Able Supply was a supplier of products to Lone Star Steel basically from the beginning of the existence of the plant.
But even if that's the case, does every one of the plaintiffs claim to have been hurt by the line?
Yes, Your Honor, in this sense. Lime, for example, is an irritant, and the lime is, when it's used in the steelmaking process, is released into the atmosphere. And it, in conjunction with a number of other irritant dust, causes what is known as a mixed dust pneumoconiosis, and can cause things like bronchitis and other things that are caused by the constant irritation of the lungs.
But does every one of these plaintiffs have it?
No, Your Honor, some do not. And with respect to those that do not, the plaintiffs have asserted claims for medical monitoring or medical surveillance, which is a theory that has not been presented to this court for decision, but has been decided in a number of other courts, that in situations where individuals who have been exposed to toxic substances at sufficient doses to which that they are at increased risk of developing disease, that they have sustained a present injury in the sense that because early detection of those diseases is beneficial for treatment, they require medical surveillance in order to have that early detection. And so, yes, there are some plaintiffs in the case who do not have a present physical injury in the sense that they're not suffering from an ailment, but we have alleged in the case and are seeking to recover damages for the medical surveillance that we contend that they will require for the remainder of their life as a result of having been exposed to these different types of substances.
If they've had medical surveillance, why can't you answer Interrogatory 30 and identify the doctors who are currently treating them and who have treated them in the past with respect to each claim?
With respect to all of the doctors who have treated the plaintiffs, those interrogatories have been answered. Those doctors have been identified. All of the records regarding the UT Tyler examinations of the plaintiffs have been provided to the defendants. All of the medical records from Lone Star Steel with respect to all of the plaintiffs have been provided, as has all of the employment records. And as the court will note in looking at the exhibits to the replies, we have attached examples of a couple of sets of interrogatory answers, and I think the court will find that those interrogatory answers are very extensive and provide a very significant amount of information with respect to each of these plaintiffs' claims.
Do you have any present projection as to how much longer it will be before you'll be in a position to answer interrogatory?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's a very important issue. As we stated in the reply, one of the most fundamental issue that we needed to get to really get the process of getting these cases ready for trial done, was the capture of all of the purchase records of Lone Star Steel, because they kept literally every record of a purchase that Lone Star Steel made over the last 50 years. And the abstracting of the information in those records into a computer database so that that information could be manipulated in order to determine what defendants, so what products at what particular periods of time, what specifically they called their products, so that we could direct discovery to the defendants to have them identify their constituent ingredients, et cetera, and so forth. That project was completed in September of 1994. Since that time, I think it is clear that the proceedings in this case have accelerated exponentially. The plaintiffs are serving interrogatories on the individual defendants, which are specifically directed to the products that they have made, and asking them very specific questions about what they've made, their toxic ingredients, what their testing has shown regarding what is released in anticipated use. The defendants have filed a motion for a trial plan. The plaintiffs have also filed a motion for a trial plan. The plaintiff's original motion for trial plan proposed trials to commence in 1996, in which there would be groups of 10 plaintiffs for trial. The defendants proposed a trial plan in which 15 plaintiffs would be selected and there would be separate trials for each of the 15 plaintiffs. The court, in a letter that is attached in the exhibits in January of this year, expressed concern with both plans that were supplied by both the plaintiffs and the defendants, specifically that with respect to common issues, that common issues under both plans would have to be relitigated over and over, which the court found would be an inefficient use of judicial resources. Secondly, the court had concern that, judging from the size of the case, that a single trial that was proposed by either of the parties would be very unwieldy and would be very difficult for a jury to decide all of the issues. In response to that letter, the plaintiffs proposed an alternative, which would be the bifurcation of liability and damages, and dividing the cases in accordance with the different products, different classes of products, so that juries would not have to look at all of the individual products and would reduce their ability, their likelihood of being confused by the evidence.
So you're projecting a trial date sometime in 1996?
Yes.
How far in advance of that trial date do you anticipate having the discovery completed so that any defendants who wish to file a motion for summary judgment may do so?
Well, let me say that, number one, with respect to the issue of summary judgments, a number of defendants have filed summary judgments with respect to different issues in the case. In fact, we had hearings on Friday with respect to a number of those. With respect to how the cases are structured, I think the one thing that the court has to do is that the court has to tell us, and I anticipate that the court will tell us since both parties have asked for it, that a smaller group of the plaintiffs be isolated so that the intense discovery process can be isolated to those parties, and so that the focus can be made on, number one, establishing the specific causation issue with respect to those test group of plaintiffs, and then establishing the liability issues against the defendants, so that defendants who don't belong in this litigation, if there are any that are still left, can get out of the case, and so that the evidence can be brought forward in a test case for all of the parties to see, which will force all of the parties, I think, to make decisions about the resolution of the cases.
Is it possible even to talk about that, though, without an answer to question 30?
Your Honor, question number 30 will have to be answered.
You're planning a trial. You're planning how these cases are going to be tried. 8 years have passed, and we still don't have an answer to question 30, as I guess it's true to any one of the plaintiffs?
That's correct at the present time. The plan that the plaintiffs have proposed and the plan that the defendants proposed both contain deadlines for the designation of expert witnesses, which of course would include expert witnesses on the issue of causation. The thing that needs to be done, and that I anticipate that the court will do since both of the parties have asked the court to do it, is to isolate a group of the plaintiffs, a smaller representative group, so that those issues can be focused upon and dealt with and brought to trial at an early date.
Why should that be the case? Why aren't the defendants entitled to know as much about plaintiff's claims, what their ailments are and what caused them, as you're entitled to know about what products were supplied over the course of 50 years?
They are entitled to know those things, Your Honor. The question is how does the court structure The development and disclosure of that information in a manner that is practically and logistically feasible.
And I've asked you that question, and your answer, as I understand it, is we get to find out everything there is to know, and then we're going to tell them in groups of 10 or 15 the answer to this question, then we're going to trial.
When we get to that point in the case, the factual basis which underlies the ultimate decision of causation will have been developed, and therefore the rate of disclosure of that information with respect to the remaining defendants will require a much shorter period of time than it will to get to the initial group of test plaintiffs.
So you need to develop a theory of causation before you can answer factual interrogatories?
Not the theory of causation. Develop the underlying evidence of exposure, dose, duration, constituent ingredients, sufficient to which that the individuals can say that it is this defendant's product that released this product that caused this injury.
Well, can't, why does, if that's the case, and I don't doubt it, why can't you just tell the defendants what medical practitioner has attributed their injury to the products that were delivered to this plant? You can, you might, the answer might be no one has, but still not defeat your case in the sense that you can develop through expert testimony your causation.
With respect to the plaintiffs themselves, as to who, what medical practitioner has told them specifically that question, the answer, based on the depositions that have been taken in the case, has been that they haven't been told that.
So why should a party have to go to the tremendous expense of 500 depositions when an interrogatory, which would, is designed to elicit exactly the same information, has been remained unanswered for all these years?
Because what the defendants have asked for is goes beyond that question, and really, at least what they brought, appear to be asking for in this extraordinary mandamus proceeding is that the plaintiffs be ordered at the present time, I assume, to designate the expert witnesses who will testify on causation.
Mr. Rhodes, let me ask you. You are representing the plaintiffs, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you're asserting that they have suffered injury as a result of the conduct or the products of the defendants, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you are telling this court that you cannot answer a question on a critical issue in this case that would establish liability on behalf of the defendants until after the defendants provide you all the information that they have?
Not with the specificity to which the interrogatory calls for.
Well, you haven't objected to the breadth of the interrogatory. My question is this. If you're the plaintiff and you have the burden of proof, how is it we find ourselves in the circumstance of this case where you don't have to demonstrate your proof by interrogatories or by any discovery until after the defendants come forward and make some sort of proof of a non-existence of a fact?
The plaintiffs have a significant body of evidence related to the question of what products are used in the steel mill, what exposures exist, what health problems are associated with those types of problems. If the interrogatory had asked, and if they had asked the trial court, tell us that information, tell us what you know and what you can develop and what you have developed in the case, then I think that there would be a very different result in what has been asked. What the interrogatory asked, in essence, is the product of all of the discovery, the factual discovery, which is yet to be developed in this case, which is necessary as the factual basis for the ultimate expert opinions that are rendered in the case. And that's the problem and the distinction that I think is important in deciding why it is that this mandamus is inappropriate.
So I'm clear. You read Interrogatory 30 to only ask for the information about experts that have said that Mr. Martin's client's particular steel pipe caused the injury that I see in this patient.
I read it to be that specific. Yes, Your Honor.
Now, when you say you haven't developed that information, you otherwise do have doctors that have already identified that this plaintiff suffers from an injury that could be caused by a steel pipe, but we're not sure that the steel pipe was provided by that defendant.
For example, an individual who works in the coke ovens, they're exposed to polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons from the coke oven emissions. There are epidemiologic studies showing that there's a much higher incidence of skin cancer, kidney cancer, and lung cancer in individuals who work in proximity to a coke oven. The physician can certainly say that this individual, based on his history, worked around the coke oven. The epidemiologic evidence indicates that exposures to these particular fumes is associated with these products. And this individual either does or does not at the present time have that particular injury. The physician is certainly not in a position at this point in the discovery to say that this defendant supplied this amount of coal, this defendant supplied this amount of coal, et cetera, and so forth, in order to make the ultimate causation issue with respect to the individual defendants.
So your answer to interrogatory number 30 for those plaintiffs would be no one has told us that my injuries are attributed to the defendant's product at this time. But we're exploring the matter further and anticipate presenting expert testimony at a later point.
No one has told the plaintiffs that's correct.
So why can't you say that in answer to interrogatory number 30?
I assume that we can, Judge. I guess it's a question in terms of how you read the interrogatory.
Maybe we're making some progress in discovery here in the state's highest court, in this courtroom. But can you explain to me why you just couldn't give that answer in writing and perhaps alleviate the need for this proceeding?
Because we read the interrogatory as to not ask for information as simple as what Your Honor has characterized the interrogatory. The court will review the argument of the relators seem to be asking this court to say that no, that's not what we want. We want the experts designated and we want their opinions now. And certainly we can provide them with the general information regarding exposures in steel mills, particular areas of the steel mills, diseases associated with exposure to products that are anticipated to be released and used within the steel mill, and those sorts of things.
Mr. Roach, I just heard, though, Mr. Martin get up there saying that after 8.5 years, he still does not know which plaintiff is claiming an injury that was produced by any product that his clients sold. Now, that's that after 8.5 years. I assume you've had hearing after hearing in front of the trial judge. It would seem to me that would be the simplest resolution of this problem. The trial judge writes a letter and says defendants are being held hostage, but there's no solution. It seems to me the most simple solution in front of the trial court would have been for you to acknowledge, Judge, they want us to say that their product caused this. I can't tell you that, but my client suffers this disease. The literature says this disease is caused by certain chemicals which we believe is in this product. Seems to me the only thing that we plead in here is Mr. Martin is pleading, just tell me which of your plaintiffs are claiming were injured by mine. Now, you told us, and I accept your sincerity, that all thousands of these plaintiffs were exposed to Mr. Martin's client's products, the chemicals that were contained in those products. Perhaps that's the case. It seems to me he now has his answer today. But I don't understand all of what's come up here to be the result of, because this is so specifically written, is the only reason you can't answer.
The defendants have not asked the court, and frankly have not asked the plaintiffs by virtue of discovery or otherwise, to state the information as Your Honor has voiced just a moment ago. That would be a fair question to ask at this point in the proceeding. It hasn't been asked, and it hasn't been presented to the trial court. And that's the distinction. Were the question asked that we want the plaintiffs to identify what they know with respect to products and exposures in various parts of the steel mill, what they know with regard to what diseases are associated to which products, and that sort of thing, then I think there would have been a much different result in the trial court than there was. And I think that they would receive that information. I would simply point out that one thing I think is important is that this case does not involve the denial of discovery. It involves the abatement of discovery. And I think that the facts of this case are very close and very similar to the case of Polaris Investment Management Corporation versus ABSCO, which this court handed a curing opinion down a little more than a month ago.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
May it please this honorable court. 4 years and 9 months ago, I stood at this podium and argued another mandamus action in this case. And at that time, the case had been on file about 3 years. And yet venue was still unresolved. The case had not been set for trial. Defense costs were already in the millions of dollars. And yet the plaintiffs had produced no medical evidence linking their injuries to exposure to the defendant's products. Today, the case has been on file almost 8 years. Venue is still unresolved. The case is still not set for trial. Defense costs are now in the tens of millions of dollars, and the plaintiffs have still not produced medical evidence linking their illnesses to the defendant's product.
Now, they have produced their own doctor's medical records.
Some of them have, Your Honor, and some have not. Those are being produced seriatim, and we have not gotten anywhere near all of those. What we do not have from any doctor, except in the case, a few obvious cases of asbestos-induced disease, is a statement by that doctor linking an illness that that plaintiff has to exposure to any specific allegedly toxic product. And in a toxic tort case, that kind of evidence is required. Medical causation cannot be inferred by a lay jury in a toxic tort case, and so that information is critical to the case. Now, this is not a contention interrogatory. We know the plaintiffs are contentious. As you heard in the state today, and as they've stated in their pleadings, they contend that each of the 2,500 living and deceased plaintiffs was harmed by exposure to each of the 180 defendants' products. That is a very bold and sweeping claim. But it is time, after 8 years, that we pass beyond claims and begin to look at evidence. And interrogatory number 30 asks for a piece of that evidence, namely a historical fact. Which health care provider has attributed each plaintiff's illness to exposure to a defendant's product, and what is that product? That is not a matter about which there can be much uncertainty. As the plaintiff's counsel told the respondent, either the answer is no one, in which case the plaintiffs have nothing to say, or the answer is someone, in which case they do.
It's very difficult for the state's highest court to intervene in a discovery proceeding in the trial court that does not involve a legal issue of privilege or a procedural issue or something significant to the jurisprudence of the state. How does this case commend itself to that sort of relief?
I think you have to go back to the court's pronouncements in Walker versus Packer, where it identified those situations where it will intervene and contrast them with situations where it won't. And the cornerstone of that is whether a party is being deprived of a reasonable opportunity to develop the merits of their case. Now, that has two aspects to it. One is there a permanent deprivation? And we believe there is a permanent deprivation in this case. Since the filing of this case, hundreds of plaintiffs have died. As Mr. Martin indicated, these plaintiffs are typically in their 60s and 70s and some older than that. Hundreds of plaintiffs have died, and many, many of those plaintiffs were died before they could be deposed. We will never know what those plaintiffs would have said about what their doctors told them about their illnesses. Likewise, some of the treating physicians have died. And likewise, as time goes on, the defendants are less and less able to muster the proof necessary to show that a particular product did not cause a particular plaintiff's illness. So that passage of time has caused an irreparable loss of some discoverable and relevant information. Additionally, although the court in Walker versus Packer said that delay and expense were not matters of which it would take cognizance on mandamus, that was said in the context of a case that had been around for a finite period of time. And to delay virtually indefinitely discovery going to the heart of the case, we believe creates a different set of circumstances than this court was talking about in Walker versus Packer. I would hope that if we were before this court 20 years from now and still didn't have an answer to interrogatory number 30, we would not be met with the principle that delay in expense is not cognizable on mandates. There has to come a limit somewhere, and the due process consideration of notice and an opportunity to be heard, we think, includes the concept of an opportunity to be heard in one's lifetime when the facts are still fresh, when the witnesses are still alive, and when the case can be developed properly. So we think both, and Justice Rickoff in his concurring opinion in the Polaris case mentioned that notion, that ordinary delay in expense may not be cognizable, but extraordinary delay in expense ought to be cognizable, and we think that by any standard we have reached the point of extraordinary delay in expense. Particularly is that the case when the discovery at issue here is within the plaintiff's knowledge and was within the plaintiff's knowledge in January of 1988. This is not a question of the trial court having to determine what the party's time and energy will be devoted to in an ordinary sequence of events. That would be within the trial court's discretion, although to hold off for 8 years, we think even there would be an abuse of that discretion. But this is a question of providing basic information, just like name, address, and phone number, and names of witnesses with relevant facts.
Mr. Young, let me ask a question. It appears from the trial court's management order that the defendants have been directed to produce certain information, and the plaintiffs are not required to do any answering on this question 30 until that information is produced. Is all the information that has been requested been produced by the defendants?
Well, I don't think Your Honor quite accurately characterizes the case management order. There's no linkage in the case management order between interrogatory number 30 and, for example, the product notebooks.
Now, isn't there a letter from the judge that talks about certain documents being put into the computer and all that being calculated, and when that's not, until that's finished, the plaintiffs don't have to produce this answer?
There may be such a letter, Your Honor. Number one, that process has been completed, as Mr. Roach told you, it was completed last September. Number two, the information that's being provided in those product notebooks, first of all, is required to be provided only by product manufacturers. Second, is not required to be provided until after the completion of the in extremis depositions, that is, depositions of plaintiffs who are expected to die, and that process has not yet been completed. So the timing is that those notebook submissions are not yet due. In any event, those notebook submissions are not necessary for the plaintiffs to answer interrogatory number 30.
But doesn't that play into the issue of the discretion of the trial court? Aren't we in an area where the defendants are saying, over the passage of time, we've been prejudiced because they haven't answered this, and the plaintiffs come back and say, but Judge, this is just what the trial court can do as long as we're waiting for the defendants to give us some information, then how can it be an abuse of the discretion for the trial court to refuse to require an answer to this question and not be an abuse of discretion for the trial court to not have sanctioned the defendants for having failed to provide these notebooks, et cetera?
The notebooks aren't due yet, and it's an abuse of discretion for a trial court to say, 10 years from now, you're going to have to provide notebooks, and I'm not going to require the plaintiffs to give basic information that's within their possession already until you've provided those notebooks, when in fact the notebook information is not needed by the plaintiffs to answer the interrogatory. The plaintiffs in the summer of 1988 filed an amended petition identifying 161 chemical substances, which they said had caused their illnesses. Very well and good. What we want to know is what medical practitioner has said what the plaintiff said in that amended petition, namely that some or all of those 161 chemical substances caused an injury to Mr. Fowler or to Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones. And that was information that they had in January of 1988. They may not know that it was Acme Model 101 asbestos, but if in fact the doctor has said, sir, you have asbestosis and it comes from working around asbestos, then that is something we're entitled to know. And the same with respect to lime and welding rods and all of the products, the paper clips, all the products that they've sued about. So there's no linkage between the product notebooks, which serve to link particular defendants' brand name type products to a plaintiff's exposure. And the answer to interrogatory number 30, they already know what the chemical substances are that are involved, and they have the capability of answering that interrogatory. Interrogatory number 30 is not a panacea for putting this case on track for a prompt and fair trial. It is one step in that process. The defendants have asked the trial court for a fair, lawful, and constitutional trial plan. They have pressed the trial court for a prompt trial date. They have sought a screening mechanism to screen the potentially triable cases from what appear to be the mass of meritless cases in this case. And they believe it is time after almost 8 years not only to receive an answer to interrogatory number 30 regarding historical physician information, but interrogatory number 31 regarding expert witnesses. Those matters are not yet before this court. What is before this court is interrogatory number 30, which asks for fundamental information already known to the defendants, which goes to the heart of the plaintiff's case and the defendant's defense of that case. In 1995, 7.5 years into this litigation, we believe it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to require that information to be promptly produced. The court has no further questions. That concludes my argument.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Okay, we're
supposed to mention that we had in section 2 of the brief, he alleges that we did not have Exhibit 25 before the trial court. We checked out the exhibits before the trial court. Exhibit 25 is in there, and I believe Mr. Roach stipulated his statement in the reply was wrong. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. So that concludes the argument in the first call, and the court will now...